Welcome to Venturi's Voice. I'm Andy Davis. Venturi's Voice brings together thought leaders from a variety of industries who are taking the most innovative approaches to leadership and staffing. Imagine having a mix of experienced mentors sharing their secrets on leadership, recruiting, onboarding, engagement, and motivating, as well as stories on life lessons they've learned along the way. And it's free. If you're the head of a major corporation leading a team of hundreds or about to take on your first leadership role, this podcast is for you. This show is about you, and we're here to help you become the best leader you can be. Stay up to date with the latest shows by subscribing on iTunes and SoundCloud, as well as signing up to the newsletter at venturi-group.com, where you can find the latest IT jobs, talent, and blogs on all things leadership, staffing, and development. I'd love to hear from you, so drop me a line anytime via email at andy.davis@venturi-group.com. Any feedback or requests are always welcome. Enjoy the show. Today's guest is David Morgantini, VP of Engineering at Test Global.
It's actually interesting that you say you've always kind of wanted that leadership role. Typically, you don't hear that as much, I don't think, from developers. And one of the actual themes I've heard recently from different organizations is that they're now having to create alternative paths for technical people. So if they don't want to go into that kind of management leadership role, then they are kind of carving out, you know, a similar path where they don't have to do that kind of work, but, you know, where it allows them to still progress if they're still kind of remaining technical. And that seems like a common theme, but you're approaching it from a leadership perspective. So that's interesting that you've kind of always been kind of motivated to do that.
So I think it has, it's kind of a multifaceted thing. When I say that I've always been interested in being a leader, it's kind of, I mean, if we go back to my personality, way back in, say, school, 25 years ago, it was kind of one of those things that I always just did. So I did, there were two things I did. I wrote code. I started writing code when I was 6, and I bossed people around. Which has obviously, my leadership skills have evolved since I was 8 years old. But I would say that I have a pathological need to kind of coach people. And as I kind of went through my career, as I actually started being an engineer, I've worked with a fair number of different managers. I'm one of those engineers that moves jobs very regularly. So I worked with a fair number of managers, and each one that I worked with, I exhibited some degrees of weaknesses in areas, and what I kind of, I mean, there were some really strong ones that I really looked up to, and there were some that maybe weren't quite so strong. And for each one of those, both the companies that I was working at and the managers that I was working for, I would look at it, and when I left the company, I would say, okay, you know what, this is something that I could improve. This is something that if I were doing it, I would do it differently. I would do it better. And it was kind of that mentality that sort of drove me down this path to get to a point where now I look after 43 engineers at Tez, and I'm trying to make sure that the things I do are the things that I would have wanted to have done for me 6 to 10 years ago, right? To make sure. And it's kind of interesting to come back to that path, that growth thing that you say. Yes, you're absolutely right. There needs to be different paths for engineers, depending on whether they want to go down that technical path or that leadership path or something in between. And for me, it was just always one of those things. It was like, okay, the leadership path is the direction I'm going to go. So it was never really a question.
Yeah. Do you think that that's quite rare from your experiences, or do you think that it's almost something that seems like quite a cool thing to say as a techie, is like, oh no, I just want to always work it on the technical side? Or do you think that more people are motivated to buy those kind of leadership roles?
I would say it's about 75, well, maybe 50-50. I don't know, it's hard to say. So in my current team of about 43 engineers, I would say there are probably 10 people that are directly like that have a clear path to say, this, I want to do your job one day, or I want to do something similar to your job one day. I'd say that there are a fair number of people who, like the other 30, are kind of somewhere in the middle between that. I want to, maybe I just want to lead a small team of three to five people, and that's it, right? That's as much leadership as I'm ever really keen on doing. Or, because I mean, if we talk about leadership, leadership itself has a massive degree of scope. So you can have leadership at the very micro level in terms of I am leading from within a team by doing the things that are important to that team. By it might be just making sure that the retrospectives or the stand-ups are happening on time. That is a form of leadership that some people are going to take. And then if we go to the more extreme, of course, obviously the CTO or CEO levels. Or a CTO at a CEO at a more technical company, of course, and CTO at a less technical company. There's obviously that broad leadership of where you're deciding, rather than actually leading individuals, you're kind of leading that entire company. So I think that it's definitely everybody wants to have some degree of leadership. At least the types of engineers that I want to work with, they all will exhibit some degree of leadership. Because if you're not exhibiting some degree of leadership, then you are a recluse working by yourself. You don't want to talk to people. You don't want to do anything. You don't want to be involved in other people. And I think as soon as you start to involve yourself with other people, you do take on a bit of that leadership role. So I'd say it's definitely rare for people to say, yes, I definitely want that role, especially once they start to realize what the role actually entails when you are responsible for the care and happiness of 40 odd individuals. But I'd say that there definitely are people, definitely are engineers that are looking at, but there are just as many engineers who just want to work on a team of four people or actually have very, very little, desires for leadership. And I think it's really, really important. And one of the things that I'm really working on at Tez is to make sure that you are catering for both and that you're identifying individuals. And so you're not saying to somebody who's definitely on the technical track, hey, listen, I want you to lead this team or to lead this project or to do whatever. But what's also interesting is that what's also really interesting and important is that people can change their minds. So as a bit of an anecdote, we had an engineer here at Tez who was adamant that he didn't want to do any leadership. That he was like, you know what, listen, I'll take a little bit of a pay reduction so I don't have to do any leadership. And then that's fine. So I kind of took that into account. I said, all right, well, I'm not going to try to push you into any of these roles, and everybody's happy. And about 2 or 3 months back, we started to introduce a new level of engineering leaders. So kind of to give previously we just had the technical track where there wasn't really any differentiation between the leadership and the technical. And now we've kind of separated those out explicitly. And when I separated those out, this person actually said, hey, you know what? That's something that actually would interest me. So it's quite interesting that you can't really just say, hey, just because somebody has said no a year ago means that they still would say no. Maybe they actually are interested in taking that step. So it definitely is something that changes
fairly regularly. It's interesting as well, like you have to open up these different silos for people to keep them kind of engaged. Because although people do say, I want to stay in a technical role, just because we're humans and by human nature, anyone who's particularly good at something, they just want to continue to get better and acknowledge for that. So they want to see a progression of some sort or, you know, moving up the ladder, so to speak. So you have to kind of create these things to keep them engaged. Even though I think that sometimes we kid ourselves that like, oh no, like this is fine, whatever. It doesn't last long. You know, no. People always want to see that progress of some sort. So from like a high level leadership position, you know, creating these silos and these opportunities for people, you know, even if they just sound cool, you know, it actually makes a huge difference.
So I think, I think it's really interesting that opportunity thing. So the problem is, I think, especially when you have a relatively small engineering organization like Tez does, where we only have about 45 engineers, the opportunities for growth per se, like say the traditional style of growth, i.e. you're a junior engineer, you're a engineer, you're a senior engineer, you're a system engineer, blah, 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 they're limited. right? Like you can only have, say, if you're generous, you might have 6 grades for an engineer, right? So what that means is that if you focus growth on the movement of somebody between those grades, then you're going to fail. Because at one point, you can't, even if somebody is growing very, very quickly, you still can't actually promote them once every year, right? And even if you do, after 6 years, you've got somebody at your top band, and then they stop, right? They stop being able to progress within your company at that traditional approach. And so I think what's really important is to make sure that you have a mechanism in place that allows you to actually visualize where people are growing and growing outside of that traditional thing. So what we use at TES is actually a pretty big spreadsheet filled with a whole bunch of levels. So for levels from like beginner to advanced, and columns which have different skill types, so like technical skill or leadership skills or architecture or community engagement or this, so on. So it ends up being quite this big spreadsheet. And what we do is we then put a set of skills that exhibit, say, a novice technical skill. What does it mean to be to have novice technical skill at TES, or advanced leadership skills at TES, right? So we have this really big spreadsheet. And then what we do is we allow people to start to fill this stuff in, right? So they say, yes, I am an experienced beginner technically, but I have these other leadership skills. And what that gives me is a much more rich model that I can start to use to actually help provide that growth, those growth opportunities outside of the traditional opportunities that you get via different names. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, no, it does. It does. And it's all part of the psyche, isn't it? And I think that as a leader, it's very much kind of a psychological process for people. You know, we create all these things that allow them to be comfortable and allow them to achieve, you know, yes. As well as obviously having, you know, the KPIs. I'd be interested to know, like, you know, how KPI driven are you, and what's your kind of take on that whole kind of model of KPIs and being really rigorous on the those kind of numbers and such?
So I'll be fairly honest with you. I worship at the church of Daniel Pink. Daniel Pink wrote the book Drive, which covers, if anybody listening hasn't read it already and they're in a position of leadership, then they should almost certainly pick it up and read it. It's a fantastic book, and what it covers is these three concepts of motivation, right? What actually motivates people to work? And the three concepts that they talk about is autonomy, so being able to make decisions to work, to do the work the way that you feel that you need to do. And it was kind of interesting. I'm just going to touch on autonomy really quickly. I was at a leadership summit very recently here in London, and somebody's like, oh no, autonomy is really bad. Basically, it's like giving a kid a pair of scissors and seeing what happens with the pair of scissors. And I just felt to myself, that's not really, that is what autonomy is, right? Like literally, if I just give a tool to a person and say, hey, you're autonomous, do whatever you want, obviously you're not going to get anything. So that's where leadership comes in, to the concept of autonomy, which is that you actually need to provide them an intent, right? So I'm going to give you a pair of scissors because I also want you to make a really nice piece of origami or whatever that art is where you chop up paper. So that's kind of the concept of autonomy. And if you start with autonomy, as that's going to provide some of that motivation. But that means that what you need to do is, when we talk back to the KPI stuff, is actually saying, okay, well, my intent is that we improve these KPIs. Now, at TES, we don't use KPIs, but the idea is that you provide intent for autonomy via some mechanism, whether it's KPIs or simply just telling people what our objectives are and what kind of things we feel that we need to get done. So that's the autonomy aspect. Then there is mastery. So mastery is what we talked about earlier around the growth, right? Giving people the opportunity to grow and continue to go to get forward. So providing them a framework or something that says, how do I visualize how I'm improving? How do I get better at what I'm doing? And whether that's along that technical track or around the people track or leadership track or some version of all three, of both of them, sorry, either, leadership or technical. And the last one is purpose. That's the last aspect for motivation. It's like, why am I doing this? Right. And that's part of that intent, but it's actually feeling engaged in what either the organization or the team that you're working on actually does. Like, am I doing something that is useful? Right. Because people don't want to be doing something that is useless, obviously. Instead of focusing on KPI, or KPIs or reporting or anything like that, I spend most of my time looking at these three things, autonomy, mastery, and purpose, and saying, how do I improve that? How do I give people more autonomy, but also providing, making sure that they have the intent that we're trying to actually achieve? How do I help people grow as much as I can within the bounds, of course, of we have a business and we can't just send everybody on courses for years and years. And how do we make sure that the work people are doing is relevant and interesting and has some degree of purpose for them? So that's really the focus for me. So it's much more lightweight process, but probably in fact takes much more effort, because I can't just say, hey, here's some numbers that you have to hit. Go ahead and hit them. I need to actually think about, how do I take person X and say, all right, Mr. X or Mrs. X or Ms. X or whatever, get yourself to be more autonomous. Like, how do you actually do that? And that, in my mind, is the crux of my job, is to find out how to improve those things.
Yeah. Well, I think it's interesting on the purpose side, actually. As a leader, I think it's so important that what you say is consistent as far as what the end goal is. You know, the nuances throughout projects can change. That's always subject to change. There's always curveballs, to use an American terminology, thrown at us. And, you know, we have to be, agile in our approach. But at the same time, that vision remains. And I think that for me, that's so, so important, because as well for engagement and, you know, reduction in churn of staff and things like that, because, you know, they're sold on what you tell them from the first day you meet them on what you're trying to achieve. And if that's not held consistent, and I think as much as held consistent, it's made visible to them consistently as well, then, then you're going to struggle.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree with you 100%. I think the one thing to add to that, and I think you touched on it very briefly, was that, your vision doesn't necessarily have to be the company vision. The team that you're recruiting in can have its own, say, micro vision that should ideally in a decent company, relate some way to the company's vision, but you aren't necessarily going to be able to sell people on a business that does something that's really boring, right? Like, that's not going to be why people join. And if you want motivated people and you want good people, then you need to find, say, within your engineering team, how do I build a vision for this engineering team to be a really interested, a really cool place to work, or a place that is going to focus on your growth or cool technology or whatever. And how do you communicate that vision? So I agree absolutely 100% with you. I think it's really important. And I think here at TES, we have a great vision for TES itself, but I also have a slightly different vision for the engineering team, which will then, of course, help out with that company vision as well.
And also something probably I can imagine quite difficult, you know, in some instances to get talent, because, they don't understand that initially. And I suppose, you know, it's... That's always going to be a battle, I suppose, from the recruitment standpoint, but certainly from, you know, the engagement perspective and, continuing to make them aware of what you're working towards. I think, is that something that, you know, you in particular have to make a conscious effort to remind people of, you know, the vision that you have for your team? Is it something that you have to make very visible, so that people remember, you know, when they're, you know, going down a particular rabbit hole on a project and they forget what they're kind of working towards? Do you need to make that conscious effort, or do you think that, your team kind of?
I don't think you need to make a conscious effort, but to specifically do that, to do the reminding people the vision, I think you need to have a conscious effort to continually keep in touch with all of the engineers that are on the team. So the communication of the vision is something that happens as you deal with issues or things come up or changes happen or whatever, right? You're continually just saying, well, we're making this change because of this reason, and this is how we're going to deal with this particular thing because of this part of the vision that we have, right? But I think that a big part of what we do here at TES is our mentorship program, in terms of how do we keep in touch, and what mentors do, because we have a fairly flat hierarchy. The mentors are just somebody to talk to. So every engineer has an opportunity every 2 weeks to talk to their mentor for a half hour or longer if needed. And I think it's part of that particular thing. And then of course I have conversations with mentors or with other engineers. And so it's part of those conversations that whenever somebody feels like there might be strain or they might not be quite understanding or getting to a rabbit hole or whatever, that you have an opportunity to reel them back in. So it's not something about, I would say it's definitely not about just continuing saying, oh, I have to make this vision. It's about taking care of people. And it's about looking at how am I, again, it's those three concepts. So yes, while vision is important, it's also really important to make sure that you're always giving them the autonomy and that you're always helping people grow and get better. And as long as you just keep on that regular cadence of conversation. So for example, so we also, in addition to that mentorship program, I personally have a conversation with every engineer every 6 months. And again, this is just that mechanism that we use. Now, of course, again, it's a relatively small engineering organization with only 43 engineers, so it's not an impossible thing for me to do. I recognize if other organizations with 300-odd engineers, your VP of engineering is not going to be having a one-to-one conversation with every engineer. But it's kind of that continually touching in and continually having those relationships that allows you to not have to remind people the vision, because you're always talking about the vision. You're always having that conversation and reinforcing your ideas and your plans.
It is important. Yeah, I think so. I think that there's a buy-in, isn't there? And I think specifically for technical people, it seems to be even more paramount. And I don't know whether that's just because they're in such demand. But it's probably more so important in technology now that these things are made obvious. I mean, you know, they have to be motivated by a lot of different facets, I suppose.
100%. I think that that as part of my recruitment challenge is often trying to, because the we can't always necessarily compete with, say, a bank, right? Like, Almost every engineer here at TES, and I've told them this multiple times, can go and get 20K more at a bank, right? I mean, pretty much every engineer of anybody who's listening to this podcast probably could leave today and go get a contract role at a bank and make quite a significant amount of money. So part of that has to be, part of that recruitment challenge is saying, okay, this is what we do to make sure that we're taking care of you. These are the things that we provide you to provide you more autonomy, to help you grow, to help you, to give you a purpose and a vision as to what we're trying to accomplish. And it's absolutely something that communicating that, and part of the recruitment is a differentiator, I feel, for TES, as we, recruitment's hard for everybody in technology, but people definitely expect that. People do want to go places where they're given more freedom, where people aren't looking at them and saying, oh, you're in at 9 o'clock. Okay. Oh, no, you left 4:59. That's not good. People don't want that. And that's just not the most effective way to work. So people want to know that they're coming to a place which is flexible, that's some work from home when they need to, which provides them the vacation that they need to recharge and to work to do the best work they can. And it definitely is a communication of that during the recruitment process that I feel actually can make a differentiation between being able to say, why would you go work for a bank where you need to wear a tie, show up at 8:59 every morning, leave at 5 and not feel like you've accomplished anything all day. While here, you'll be able to come in at 10, As long as you're in for your stand-up and your team is happy, deliver three times into production during the day, and then go home at whenever you feel like it, right? Whenever your work's done. And I think that's really important as well, is just to give that that flexibility and trust, really.
Yeah, well, I think, I was just about to say, I think it's a massive trust thing, isn't it? I think that if people have that autonomy and it's just like, yeah, I don't, whatever, I don't care if you come in at half an hour, like, why do I care? Like, oh, I've got to take care of the kids really quick. Great, go do it. Like, why does that, you know, why people, if you kind of reassure them that, like, it doesn't make too much difference, you know, the time thing, and specifically as well, seems to be just such a burden in a lot of instances, doesn't it, you know?
Yeah.
And it, you know, people have crazy lives, you know, you've got children, you've got responsibilities, you know, things go wrong, we've got train strikes, you know, that get thrown on us.
Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, I mean, and I think that just knowing and feeling comfortable that, like, oh, if I show up half an hour late here, my boss isn't going to be like, have to have a serious word with me because he trusts me. I think that just makes people feel confident, comfortable, and just, you know, a little bit less stress yeah. in their lives, you know.
Yeah, I think, and I think the key things, there's a couple key things that enable me to be able to trust the engineers that work here. I mean, one is basically, the first thing to start with is you are trusted until you prove that you are not trustable, right? And I think if you start with that, then you actually go a long way to getting to the right place. The second thing, and the reality is, there are people who will take the piss, right? Like it's just a thing. Unfortunately, there are people who don't do very much work, who are not interested in actually contributing. And I think a big thing for me, at least when we talk about the recruitment pipeline, is A, probation's there for a reason. So if you identify somebody that is not able to be trusted or is not capable of doing the job you need them to do, then you need to move on, for their benefit and for yours. B, we actually work in an industry where while it is incredibly difficult to measure productivity, and I challenge anybody who says measuring engineering productivity is incredibly easy, because it's really, really not. It depends on so many factors, including the team they're working on, the technology, the code base, their experience, everything. It is actually possible on a micro level to know whether somebody is actually working hard or not. And even if that person is remote, I mean, we at TES, we have about 20 odd engineers that never show up in the office because they live in South Africa or in Italy or Spain or the US or whatever. So even if you don't have them there, you can still tell if somebody is not committing any code and your culture is to commit code, or if people aren't showing up to stand-ups and your culture is that you have to show up to stand-ups, then you will know about these things. So basically for me, I tell every engineer at TES, I don't actually care when you're in the office, when you're not in the office, when you're on vacation, when you're not on vacation, unless somebody complains. Because the reality is you are going to have a team of people around you who are trying to do their best, who are motivated, who are bought in, who I trust. And if you, for whatever reason, are violating that trust, they're going to be like, well, wait a second, what's going on here? So it kind of becomes this network thing. So if you get everybody to buy into that, and everybody trusts everybody, and everybody's kind of pushing everybody to a higher standard, you actually end up in a very powerful place where you don't need to track sick days, you don't need to track vacation time as much. You need to make sure everybody takes vacation, because it's an easy thing for people to forget. It's basically, sorry, my point was that you don't need to institute all these things that some businesses, some older school businesses still do around hours. And
a culture's built on accountability of each other, right? You know, you turn to you right, and I know that guy is going to do it. And we all, like, you know, are bought into this system, and we buy into it, and we genuinely, you know, are bought into it. And that's part of the culture. It's not kind of having ping pong tables and pool tables in the middle of the office. That doesn't mean that you've got a culture. You know, it means that you've got a ping pong table in the middle of the floor. You know, it's as you said, it's all being bought into these kind of these same themes, you know, approaching each other and having respect for each other in a particular way, and going about things, it doesn't mean that we're all into the same thing. We all like to go out and get boozed up, or that, you know, we all like to go and, you know, watch horse racing or whatever, right? It's not, that's not what the culture is, right? It's this kind of, you know, buy into, you know, the activities and the way that we approach work. You know, that's my take. I'm sure there's more to it from your side as well.
I agree with you completely on those points around. I think that the culture is defined by the people and how they interact with each other, and what you do as a leader is you foster that culture, and you I wouldn't say reward, but you try to enable the behaviors that make the culture stronger, and you discourage the behaviors that reduce that culture. And I think it from my experience, it is a constant thing that you have to do is kind of helping people, because while everybody wants to do well, when we start to get stressed, when we start to get there are times where we will revert to the individualistic kind of, I'm just going to deliver something as quickly as possible, or whatever, pulling out a bit of that team kind of mentality. And then part of the leadership part is to keep on reminding people, okay, I know we might go a little bit slower if we work together, but long run will be faster, and so on and so forth. And I think when one other thing I want to touch on that you mentioned, and I think we might have talked a bit about it earlier as well, but is around that, is part of that autonomy thing about you have these startups where everybody just shows up at the coach and just works. And I think that absolutely fails, because there's no structure and there's no intent. So you just go with pure autonomy. And as I said, that's like giving a pair of scissors to a child and saying, go do something. And it's like, well, okay, they'll do something. But is that something actually what you want them to do? So I think that's kind of where, so as long as you provide that structure and you help boost that culture, you make sure that you're putting yourself into position and the team into positions where they can prop up and make sure the culture continues to be strong. Because I firmly believe that, like most things, that if you don't have an owner, if you don't have somebody actually focusing on it, then it will start to erode. If you're not continually just propping it up. So I know we did mention earlier that about the vision and so on. I definitely don't spend as much time talking about the vision, but I spend a lot of time working on the culture. A lot of time. I would say majority of my job is spent trying to help that culture be better, trying to work with the teams to make sure that they're not, that they're working together effectively, and so on and so forth. And I think that's super, super important.
Yeah. And is it difficult sometimes to, I suppose, or is it even necessary, I suppose, in some instances, to trying to correlate an ROI on the efforts made on culture and outcomes? Is it pretty easy to kind of see progress from spending that time?
So I would suggest that the only true way to measure that, because as I discussed earlier, measuring developer productivity is very, very difficult. So I don't know whether my efforts are actually making engineers more productive. I feel they are. I guess as my gut feeling is yes. I feel like the engineers are generally more productive than they would be if I wasn't doing my efforts. But one thing that you can measure is turnover. And turnover has a massive cost. Losing an engineer costs an incredible amount of money, far more money than most people that deal with spreadsheets would think. Because, of course, from their point of view, it's the recruitment cost and just another box in the spreadsheet. So what are you really complaining about? But the reality is the lost opportunity cost, the lost time, and so on. So I do feel that you can definitely measure that. If you have a strong culture, you can measure, A, how long do your roles remain open? So once you have an open role, how long does it take you to fill it? And B, what's your turnover rates? And I think based on those two, you can almost certainly tell whether you have a strong culture, and you're doing things in a good way. So I'd say yes, it is possible to measure the return on investment, but not in terms of actual engineering productivity, because that's just very, very difficult.
Yeah, I agree. I'm conscious of time here, David, so we'll kind of shut things down on this point. But thank you so much for taking the time, mate. It was, really interesting conversation.
Perfect. Thank you very much, Andy.
Thanks for listening to Venturi's Voice. Please make sure you subscribe at iTunes or SoundCloud, or check out the website, venturi-group.com, and keep up to date with the latest IT jobs, talent, news, and podcasts. Or drop me a line. It's andy.davis@venturi-group.com. Any feedback, topics, or guest suggestions are always welcome. And thanks again for listening to the show. See you next time.